Well, hi there, all of you, from Woman Made Gallery, and for myself, Nina Corwin, who is RM, the literary curator, who doesn't know her verbs properly, the literary curator for Woman Made Gallery. We have a small audience here today, but a wonderful, wonderful bunch of readers and a wonderful several exhibits downstairs and up here. So I hope you'll have a chance to take a look around. Woman Made readings are now archived with Chicago Amplified, which is something that Chicago Public Radio does. And we're enjoying our partnership. And so tell your friends who weren't able to be here. We'll be getting those up on the website under Chicago Amplified Archives Woman Made Gallery. So for those of you who are reading and your friends from Milwaukee or Michigan or having brunch can't be here, they'll be able to hear you, and before we finish, probably see you. So today's reading is Myths, Sheroes, and Revolutionaries. And we have here Chingyi Chen, Maureen Flannery, Susan Slaviero, Christine Uyeda, and Jenny Priego, who is also one of the artists who, if you look in the front, you'll see some photographs that are Cindy Sherman-like portrayals of Adelita, but Jenny did that, and so she's going to be doing a performance piece at the end of the afternoon. I'm just going to say a little bit about After Adelita, which the main show is about. It was curated by Amy Galpin, who used to work here. And I'm just going to read some of the words that I think you may have written, Jenny. For many decades, the name Adelita has evoked multiple meanings. Various interpretations of Adelita identify her as a hero, a myth, and a revolutionary. Popular ballads tell the story of Adelita as a young woman who fought during the Mexican Revolution. While some believe that she is an actual historical figure, others see her as a composite of the many women who joined in battle during the revolution. The image of a female revolutionary with blouse, skirt, sombrero, and ammunition across her chest serves as an iconic representation of the revolution and of Mexican history. Songs, books, plays, films, and calendars have interpreted Adelita as a sex symbol, a brave champion of the people, and a proto-feminist. The reason for the exhibit taking place as it is because 2010 marks the 100th anniversary of the beginning of the Mexican Revolution. And we're going to have a bunch of strong, strong women reading for you today. And I look forward to hearing all of their voices. So I'm going to start by bringing up Maureen Flannery, who has read here before. She's the author of a number of books, and one, Ancestors in the Landscape, was nominated for the 2005 Pulitzer Prize. There was, the poems in A Fine Line were produced as musical theater by her actor husband, Dan. I have to, go through here because there's so much. Her other books are Secret of the Rising Up, Poems of Mexico, Remembered into Life. I think your most recent is Destiny Whispers to the Beloved, am I right? So I think that's enough. You'll just have to listen to her poems, Maureen Flannery.
Thank you, Nina, and thank you, Woman Made. It's always such an honor to be among these artists and readers. Sometimes a historical life is lived so large that it becomes legend and myth, and I think the lives of Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo are two examples of that. You all know her art, I'm sure. a couple of allusions that you may not know. The one painting with the wonderful Milagro hands, those were gifts from Picasso, those earrings that she wears. And also that if you haven't seen her art in its original, it's all very small, as large as Diego's art was. Her paintings are very tiny. She used a delicate brush. Mi Frida Loca. A lovely, diminutive girl coupled with corpulence, she had married art that was larger than life, while the eyelash tip of her brush probed deeper into her own tormented longing. Her doll was a formulan floating fetus tucked tenderly in its jar by her bed, its arrested growth observed as closely as her own inability to form it. The only screw from which she conceived was the penetration of a metal rod, the first intrusive member of her first rough lover, the bus, that pierced her to the strawberry center like a paleta stick. And the only life that grew inside her skewered womb, preparing itself for the world, was her art, small and bloody as a sucked out embryo. Split pomegranate full of abrasive juice, she spilled and transfused crimson life into her double, into her spouse, into her equally wounded world. Her kitchen is wallpapered with small tin retablos of her paisanos, each bandolera telling a life's misfortune and some miracle of divine intervention. Self-portraits of suffering bleed like plaster cracks on the other walls of her home. She painted her pain, a small girl explains to a woman staring at a graphic record of grief, an ex-voto turned inside out to commemorate a lack of the miraculous. What have we left of her mangled beauty? Pictures, small, vocal pictures. The jungle that grew from the fertile soil of her hollowed-out chest ferned itself onto her brow and lay like a kiss across her upper lip. The pinche pata that carried her around the world and back to bed. The broken ionic column of her spine rising from the empty playground of her pelvis. The birdcage of her brace, those bars she rattled like a drunken convict even as she sang bird-like within their confines. Picasso's silver hands, cupped fishing lures dropped into turbulent seas beneath her ears. And her jewels, dead hummingbird, thorns, and broken bones that shone like amber and rubies from the delicate curve of her neck. All these she conceived, and they cry to us now in many eloquent tongues. And for me, the most apt metaphor for the Mexican people is pilgrimage or procession, peregrinación, because they eagerly took up pitchfork and machete and followed the banner of Hidalgo with that same fervor that they follow the saints out of the church and process them through the streets. And they crawl on their knees long distances to the Shrine of Guadalupe, the same way they crawl across the desert to come here and change our world. Peregrinación. What goes before them is todo lo que ha pasado, and the banner, or the santo, or the Christ. What moves inside them is their faith. What falls in line behind them, marching with determination to their pace, is everything they care about. Familias, vecinos, fecundity of fields, health of the sickly child, the posibilidad of every possibility. They are pilgrims from the other side of life, caminando de otras partes. They go to the church bringing prayers, promesas, devotion, milagros, retablos they have painted to commemorate an answer to their prayers. Their sins and lamentations, their resolve, and the hope held in them as heart knows home, as rhizome remembers the shape of its blossom. On their knees they come, on calloused bare feet, in worn-through shoes, on elote stick heels of working women. They parade from the church, bringing the Virgin's healing to the streets, singing in high-pitched wails of keeners. They dance to the fiesta with abandon behind the band. Procession as profession, they go to new places for food, for work, for some unknown that must be better than the known, carrying in their muscle memory exhaustion and the dignidad of places they have prayed before. They are pilgrims and penitents, fugitives and refugees, revolutionaries and carriers of the cross, immigrants and migrants and revelers at the festival. They are an inland passage of people who become Camino in the going and coming, moving in unison along a line that alters the landscape with the life. I always think of Carlos Fuentes, who coined the phrase, the Latinization of America, which is so true. We see it in Chicago. We have been in uplifted by the culture that has been infused by the people who come here. There are many kinds of revolution, and when I think of peaceful revolution, I always figure that there is a woman or a whole community of women behind that kind of affecting change. And this was a story I'd heard about in Guatemala, one community. Supplicant activism. Can we learn this from the single-purposed people of Nawala? What it means to demand with humility, assert with all due respect. This Guatemalan farming community in subsistence need of their ancestral land could not accept the confiscation of their hillside fields, nor would they be convinced to choose a spokesman. No, every man, woman, and child in the village would go, would walk to the capital to speak to the president. It made sense to petition with one voice, request to buy back the land of their communal sustenance. After long weeks of travel, they entered the chamber together and knelt with their heads to the floor, determined, unmoved, until their lands were restored by officials baffled about how to handle a people so united, so forcefully gentle, and so right about their rights. Some of my heroes are Latina women who know how to make do with so little and create amazing worlds, sometimes with few resources. I met one of those women in Guatemala this summer, an elderly peasant who was living out one of my fantasies. She was a squatter who took up residence in an abandoned church. At home in the bosom of the church, La Antigua Guatemala. The bustling convent of Santa Rosa was toppled by an earthquake 250 years ago. Its ruins are closed to the public, massive wall portal blocked with padlocked metal grate. But Martha de Ordenas and her Señor Raimundo know how to get in and out. Behind a corrugated metal door, they live in the nave of an abandoned chapel, their straw bed against the communion rail. A trastero of utensils on a wall that once supported a statue of Santa Catalina. An orno in one roofless corner where rising smoke penetrates a patient sky. Martha's own simple shrine to San Simon is surrounded by candles and found plastic flowers set up where no altar remains. Her pila is a barrel of rainwater. Clean, threadbare garments hang on a line strung from one massive half-pillar to the remnants of a broken arch. Beside cloisters where black shadows of nuns once passed, Martha has planted red geraniums that grow lavish and lush from rusty coffee cans. Feeling on occasion lonely, she visits undisturbed bones of the holy dead in the catacombs below her home. The privileged nuns of the pious past come often through their walls, pass in and out of her dreams without asking, some of them haughty and demanding as if she were their servant. Others just pleased she is there with the tablet of her sleep for their dictation. Martha does not take them into her day. She has her own work to do. Meals for Raimundo, the milpa she grows where the vestry used to be. She may never know how the old abbess envies her every movement through the space, recalling what a grace it was to have had life, missing even the pinch of habit around her ears and the oddly pleasant chore of scrubbing iron pots and long tiled corridors. Put a marker in the wrong place. Apparition. Our Lady of the Water-Stained Cement has made her image known below the overpass. But new accidents happen as cars slow down to view her likeness in variegated shades of gray. Two ordinary sticks now cross themselves to mark the place of the soul's release to unabated space. A lily dropped from the cab of a passing semi takes root in a crack of asphalt and reblooms with funereal scent all season. The shrine of Milagro photos, plastic roses, and veladores grows into the roadway. Each new mother whose child dies asks the Virgin why the miraculous exacts so high a toll. And this legend, La Llorona, she's the weeping mother. They say she is a Medusa kind of figure who killed her own children and cries. You can hear her moaning at night and crying, wishing she had her children back or wishing she could take yours away. La Llorona, dark moon winds carry stark cries the children cannot identify. On such nights, they move their play inside to stay within reach of the weaving women who lean into backstrap looms in the room with the scent of cilantro and green chilies. Why is she crying? They finally ask. Who has broken the viejita's heart? It is La Llorona, the women tell their night-eyed niños. She weeps for her babies who flow below her reflection in the deep river. Do not follow if she calls your name. She wants you to go with her into the flowing dark braid that keeps moving away beneath the shimmering surface where stars dance. She wants to hold your warm life in her chilled, empty arms while she mourns her own bad mothering and cries eternal nights for another chance. Thank you.
That was Maureen Flannery with a perfect way to start this reading after Adelita. The next reader we have came in from Michigan, and she's a Kundiman fellow, one of two we have here today. Her poems and microfiction have appeared or are forthcoming in Rattle, Ciphers, MacGuffin, the Asian Pacific American Journal, Boxcar Poetry Review, The Collages. There's a whole bunch. And, oh, that's right, we knew this, right? That she will be in A Face to Meet the Faces, an anthology of contemporary persona poetry, which I'm also going to be in. So I was excited when you sent me that email. I was like, oh, how great. She's pursuing her MFA at Vermont College of Fine Arts and is currently at work on a collection of persona poems herself, inhabited by figures from Greek myth, fairy tales, comic books, and the Bible. You know, we're like sisters here. So I'm so thrilled to have you here, Christine Ulleda.
Thank you for the introduction, Nina, and for the invitation to read here, and also to the gallery owners. It's a pleasure to be reading in such good company, and in terms of poets and in terms of the stories that sort of inhabit the walls here. Let me know in the back if you can't hear me very well. I'm fighting some horrible congestion, so I will do my best if you give me a little signal if I'm becoming audible or difficult to hear. I'm not going to speak too much between the poems. I think they'll probably be pretty self-evident what they're about. But just in general, I've been writing a lot about, from the point of view of women characters in myth and the whole host, the Bible, comic books, fairy tales. And generally the poems tell a little moment between two episodes that have happened that in the common telling of a story, or are sort of a postscript that tell what happens after the tale that we know, or perhaps re-envision a motivation for something that occurred. And with that, I'm going to begin with Red Riding Hood. Oh, wolf, it's not dinner you've come for, or love, not even conversation, though I know your desires have turned your brothers away and you've been lonely as of late. Let us lay our mouths against each other and, in the furious accumulation of hours, consider all the ways in which our bones might come together, render, be rendered. The next two poems are companion poems, and this is actually the poem that will be appearing in A Face to Meet the Faces that Nina mentioned. This poem, Odysseus, on the eve of departure, prepares his wife. Be still, and let me tell you something. The earth is flat. In times like these, what are we willing to say we know for certain? In the ache and expanse of what has not yet happened, do not dwell. For though a man dreams of the sea, who adrift does not long for his lover, his son, the linnet, the shore? Each morning, within the field of what the sea refuses, among shell and stone, listen for a sound shaped like my name. Penelope instructs her husband on the nature of the sea. I am not a sailor, Odysseus, and what I know of the sea, if folded in half, could live in your palm like a splinter. Beyond the harbor, the sea is vast and delicious, and my name echoes beneath the wave crest like birdsong. A heart's dull thrum in time loosens the shipbuilder's surest union. A gull's call awaits no answer. Silence is refused, even in moonlight, and to be carried over will not be enough. To be delivered whole, we must first survive ourselves. I think every female poet who writes persona poems in the realm of myth eventually writes a poem about Lot's wife, and I have to say I'm no exception. Lot's wife. In the early days of our courtship, I was ravenous for details. I wanted to know how it happened. Did it slip around her from the edges like a pane of glass frosting over? Was it over in a firefly's breath? Did it grow in a slow creep from her ankles upward? Was it a sheer veil of brine that left a pale hint of woman in its wake, or plaster insofar as the eye could discern? He spoke of it on the rarest occasion, and not before a few glasses of wine. He had walked behind them to shepherd them forth, his daughters, their inconvenienced husbands, and Iris. He saw her head lift after they'd gone out of the city, and she turned to him to ask if he'd remembered to shut off the kettle or lock the back door, and realizing it made no difference, she formed an O, as in, oh, never mind. And that was what he remembered most, the bright O blooming on her lips, salting over before it could open into a word, remembered his faith transforming her. He walked past her, called out to his daughters to keep moving forward, even said, "Come on now, mother, don't fall behind. We've come too far." Every Wednesday night, the reason he married me clearer than the moment he slipped the ring over my knuckle. Chicken piccata in the sauté pan. That sweet disaster of wine after the alcohol's burned off, the shallots have loosened, caramels risen, and the pan has come clean. The capers warmed through the lemon, and with only the heat still hunkered down in the metal, the slow puddle of butter. In the finish, a little brine on the tongue, an ache of sweetness. This next poem is actually written by someone who I believe is now a Chicagoan, Marty McConnell.
And a friend of the gallery.
Oh, excellent. Well, perhaps she's read this one here before. She's written a great series of poems where saints and martyrs are speaking to pop icons or figures from today. And they're really wonderful and delightful. And once you read the title, you are just in for the rest of the ride. And I think I'm from the olden days when to find a new poet, you pretty much had to like comb the bookstore shelves or journals. And I think the internet has given us access, but there's so much. And it's still, in a way, hard to find poets. And I've realized that so many of the poets that I've come, whose work I've come to love, have been given to me by other poets, either reading or recommending them. So this poem, because it fits so well with the theme, I'm going to read one of Marty McConnell's poems. It opens with an epigraph from the New York Magazine. The context is the article was about a woman whose fame was derived from the fact that at the time she was believed to be the highest paid escort in New York. And here's the quote. Jason would be saying, Natalia is the greatest escort in the history of the world, as good as Cleopatra or Joan of Arc. And I'd be like, Jason, Joan of Arc was not an escort. She was a religious martyr. New York Magazine, July 18th, 2005. Joan of Arc to the $2,000 an hour woman. At least your pimp has a name, a neck you could put your two good hands around. He loves you like all men love what they sell, what comes back in gold. Make no mistake, my God was a man. Men with their mouths at the entrance of the cave whispering, men dripping hallucinogens into the milk, men insisting, lead us, have this horse, this sword, this sentence, this pyre. Men naked under their robes, their armor, their teeth bartering my skin for their country. A cause I would have sworn was mine. Cleo and I place bets on women like you. From this distance, your dance looks a lot like ours, and Vashti's, and Salome's, and Helen's, and you're acquainted with the Magdalene. Our mythical knees locked or spread, bringing men to theirs, and us to the gallows, the tower, the stake. Trade your corset for a habit, and they'll hate you all the same. Whatever cannot be possessed is poison. The body is never bought, but rented, which is why he wants your heart, bound like feet, dancing only for him. Let me tell you something about possession. Never let a man dictate your wingspan or your footwear. There's a God on every corner, and not one would have you mortgage your given body for this man and his fur-lined tongue. Don't think I don't know about love. More goes unreported in history than in myth. Sell your story, Natalia, before they scrape it from under your fingernails as evidence. Cut your hair. Buy a building in Brooklyn. Lay down on a bed of teeth alone. Peel back their fingerprints one by one. Each incision, the hot face of a god unfolding. So she has several poems. One of them is Catherine of Siena to Mary Kate Olson, and they're great. They have a sense of humor, but also, you know, kind of a seriousness about them too. And they're wonderful. Once you read the title, you're just hooked. You can't not read the poem. I'm going to read one final poem. This has an epigraph from the Metamorphosis, but the characters are Jove or are Zeus and Hera. Jove, in the quotation, is the Roman equivalent of Zeus. Io considers the stars. Having intuited his wife's approach, Jove had already metamorphosed Io into a gleaming heifer, a beauty still even as a cow, the Metamorphosis. Could he not have hidden me among the blades of grass or hung me beyond the ether, a star, one among the many? Anonymous and ordinary, I could have been invisible, a star shimmering in the periphery, unglimpsed, a luminous shaft of green, dew-heavy in first light. I'd trade sleep for the glimmer of my old life, my father polishing the dowry silver, mother crushing jasmine between her palms and teaching me to rake that sweet bloom through my hair. Once I dreamt myself walking in a field, current of fabric like water at my feet, my body swimming in air, and I woke to my back legs kicking beneath me. It comes to me that his wife was no doubt surprised by how easily, without so much as a backward glance, I could be parted from myself, from the usefulness of my known body budding from childhood into something more dangerous, a bare shoulder turning away, the line of a hip rising beneath the sheet. Now I lay in a field, muzzle bedded down in a constellation of violets, inhaling their tender dialect of blue. I cast one eye toward heaven and study those stars whose fires were long ago extinguished, but whose light, untethered, continues to travel.
Thank you. Thank you, Christine. You know, I was thinking about, as you were reading that, about how, you know, when you mess with the Greek gods, there's a real risk of getting turned into something else. But, you know, it occurred to me, and you can tell me if you can think of some exceptions, most of the people who get metamorphosed are females. I'm trying to think if there's a male that, you know, Prometheus gets strapped down on a rock, but, you know, women become mosquitoes and cows and trees and unfortunate things like that. Who knows what we're going to get from Susan Slaviero? Who's just had her first book of poetry come out on May Apple Press. It's called Cyborgia, which I love. She's the author of two poetry chapbooks, An Introduction to the Archetypes on Shadowbox Press, and Apocrypha with Dancing Girl Press. Her work has appeared in 14 Hills, Flyway, Caffeine Destiny, Wicked Alice, Mythic Delirium, Goblin Fruit. There's a few others, and she's on the editorial staff of Blossom Bones. She has a BA in English, creative and professional writing from Lewis University. Young but incredibly well formed as a poet. Give a hand for Susan Slaviero.
Thank you so much. I'm in good company because the first poem I was planning to read is also going to be in A Face to Meet the Faces. So look at all us anthology buddies together. So I'm excited about that. And this piece is called The Chimera Faces Extinction, Displacement. What I am has something to do with teeth, with stone gods who've forgotten my breath should be volcanic, more yellow than the nucleus of a sphinx's egg. I am portentous, luck broken. If you see me, you should find a shipwreck or something skinned and shuddering. My body reminds you of poppies, spiraling wasps in a windstorm. I will not take a stone in my mouth, swallow doves or mice, strike anything that occurs in threes. I go marauding in suburban yards, my goat spine scraping beneath your swing sets, the limbs of acacias and oaks. I slouch past your dwellings unnoticed, like a house cat during dinner hour. I don't understand your zygotes, your finely tuned and matching cells. Where are your manes, your udders? Even my plainest sister had a bouquet of heads at birth. Even your dogs seem unfinished, lacking in mosaic patterns. Today I am watching your bones, hoping to see them grow monstrous beneath your two bright skins. Maybe you will consume a cobra and evolve more useful appendages. Maybe you will grow moth-white scales when the moon drops away. So beautiful. The next couple of poems I'm going to read have much to do with the archetype of the wise woman, the crone, as we see them in various mythologies. So these are the women we either see as sort of your fairy godmothers, your witches. And the first one I want to read, if I can find it, there it is called The Hen Wife Offers Some Advice. Your mother was buried, and you forgot blushes and skirts, the locket trembling at your throat, the way a gown is mended at the wrist. You are vexed by the number 7, 7 years, 7 bricks, 7 dead hens and 7 cinders in your bare heels. Your sisters attend the hymns, and the hymns attend the weddings, and the weddings attend the girls with white sheets, spotted red-brown with maiden blood and feverwort. You must not sew yourself into that sack, or enter a church until you see the shape of bells in a honeybird's entrails. If you do this right, you will lose a red shoe. If you do this wrong, you will be cocooned in a whale's belly. You see yourself reflected in a mare's glossy side, wearing shoes of ice, a mossy cloak. When I say you can outrun this church mob, you know this is true. When a raven utters mirror, thigh, you know this is an omen. Then you will know nectar from clay, a tooth from a sword, a ghost from a husband's hand. This next one, in that same sort of idea, concept, is called the sea witch gardening. It should be easy, all diadem and oyster. Every year I grow new tentacles for tending my eel garden, for rooting tongues from pretty mouths. But this blighted plot of sand, gone to gray mire and skull bones, whirlpools sucking tendrils of my hair when I try to cultivate some amber fruit or violet-red blossom for storm potion. I scrub the grit from under my fingernails with octopus ink, a knot of snakes. There is a toad in my teeth for luck. How many sword-split tails does it take to enchant the ocean floor? Pouty girls beat at my door with tiny fists, wanting to be dragons, dryads. I whip their arms into branches, their ears into broad green leaves, distort their spines into xylem and phloem, concentric rings. They will age more quickly now. This one wants to smoke a cigarette, wear high-heeled shoes. Behind my hand, I mutter words like foam, dust, collapsed lung. I scribble a notation in my sorceress's book, a method for planting the parts they leave behind, hoping to harvest sea apples, obedient daughters. This next piece is my reimagining of Eve, the biblical Eve as a scientist, and it's called The Botanist. And it begins with a quote from Mark Twain. It was not a southern watermelon that Eve took. We know it because she repented. I love that quote. When that initial belly fruit burst open, orange red, we had language in the Kalahari. There were rinds in my stomach, juices in my husband's sucking chest wound, his rib hole quivering. Everything bleeds, the peeled pulse, empty vine sockets, the shed skins of copperheads that indicate the arrival of new shoots. I name each bud according to my own thorned tongue. Moon and stars, cream of Saskatchewan. After rain reveals my naked spine, the fissure between my legs, I sew an apron. Not out of shame, but for practicality. The leaves of climbing melons are broad as farmers' hands where they touch my sunburned skin. They show no sign of fusarium wilt, or dirt weevils. I put up jams, jars of jam under the new moon, learn the secrets of gene splicing as etched in the patterns of seeds. Somehow the most complex bodies are born of inferior ovaries. Will it happen again? Knowing what you know? I tip my chin, unsure, hoard bites of snake root in the pockets of my mouth while growing cubic gourds in glass boxes. The walls are dark with pulp. You wonder about the stains, what stories they might tell. Suddenly the wounds close. Here, I say, taste this. The last couple poems I want to read are from Cyborgia, and there's a section in Cyborgia in which there are these reimaginings of fairy tales in which the characters are cyborgs. And since you read a Little Red Riding Hood poem, I'm going to read my Little Red Riding Hood poem. And this one is called Little Red and the Robot Wolf. I am a city girl in red stilettos. What happened to all the canids? A silver wolf grinding gear teeth against my apartment door. The clicks and ticks of his clockwork belly, programmed to consume several grandmothers in one sitting, I imagine. A plague of zoomorphic automaton urban areas, they say. Sign of the times. So I keep a ray gun in my cookie jar, a taser between the sofa cushions. An electromagnetic pulse might disrupt his integrated circuit, stun him long enough for me to get an axe. Some people hunt them for their exoskeletons, which are a valuable source of fresh metal. I don a butcher's cloak, hack at the slick abdomen until it cracks. Inside, a girl in a blue dress. Together, we remove his microchips, his tubules and wires. We fill a bucket with electronic viscera. Later, we pack his empty mechanical shell with stones. This piece is called Gretel Discusses Her Prosthetic Arm. No, I don't remember how it happened. It could have been bitten off by a hungry witch or burned in her candy oven. I only recall the raw end of bone, white and pretty, the bird-like hand flopping in a stranger's kitchen. My brother slept soundly when I screamed, dosed on morphine, I think, or laudanum. Now this mechanical limb works better than flesh. I chop onions for stew with a built-in chef's knife, open wine with my corkscrew thumbs. I have become more than mere girl. I am an armory dressed in gingham and lace. You would never suspect that my ulna is a loaded gun, that the bend in my elbow bears teeth. Thank you.
That was Susan Slaviero, and I want to thank all of these three amazing readers for their wonderful renderings of characters known and unknown for some of us. Such imagination and such truth and heart lent to these characters. So now we take a 10-minute break. Wander around, buy these people's books. They are amazing. Christine, I can't wait to see yours. Take a look at the exhibits downstairs as well as the ones upstairs. And we'll see you back here in 10 minutes. I think people have been wandering around the gallery and enjoying the amazing work that's here. I keep on being reminded of how amazing this work is. And for many, many women, this work may not have gotten into men's galleries. A particular example of that is that of my friend Connie Berg, whose works are in the back room downstairs, who is 84 and is really kind of a perfect example of why Woman Made needed to be here, was to get work like that into the public eye. In the meantime, I'm going to invite Ruby Thorkelson, who's new to the gallery. It'll be like a word from our sponsor about an exhibit that Woman Made is doing off-site. And Ruby, come on up. We're so glad to have you at the gallery.
I'm so glad to be here. It's such a pleasure to have such fantastic poetry in this space. It's a real treat, so thank you, poets and audience. Just really quick, a few announcements. This is a sign-in sheet if you would like to be on our mailing list. I'm just going to put that out front. There's a lot. We ask for a lot of information. Don't feel bad about just putting in your email. That's okay. But if you'd like to fill out more, that's wonderful too. We also are very thankful for our support from 3Arts for this exhibition. They enabled us to get the work in here, get work we really wanted to have, and also print this catalog, which is available for a donation. So let me know if you would like to get a catalog. And then we also have 2 events coming up. We have Arterial Space, which is going to be an exhibition curated. It's a group exhibition curated by Woman Made at Salvage One, which is a really fantastic space in Chicago down on Hubbard Street, not far from here. There's going to be postcards up front, but the art is going to be in conversation with lots of interesting salvaged building materials and furniture. And then we also have a wine tasting party coming up in conjunction with this exhibition and in celebration of the Year of Mexico in Chicago. And we would love to see you all at that wine tasting. It's going to be the first time that Mexican wine is available in Chicago, in public, let's say. I don't know what goes on, you know, behind closed doors, but... And I think that's all. If you have any questions about any of those events or anything else, please feel free to speak with me. Thanks so much for coming.
Ruby, would you remind me how many years this gallery's been here? Not this one, but the whole Woman Made gallery?
1992 was the beginning.
All right. So
up in Ravenswood.
Coming up on 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Very exciting. Thank you.
And I want to really thank Beata Minkowski for getting this darn thing started and putting in, you know, blood, sweat, and tears to keep it going all these years. And I also want to thank my good friend, Kurt Heinz over here, who does all the recording for this so that you can all be memorialized. And he's actually going to be reading here the next reading, November, I think it's the third Sunday in November. And it's going to be a mixed gender reading, but it's actually going to be more than a mixed gender. It's going to be a multi-gender reading.
Some interstitial parties, shall we say.
That's right. All interstitial parties welcome. Ching-Yi Chen... somebody who I met, I had the opportunity, wonderful opportunity to meet when we were both at Provincetown working with Cyrus Cassells. And he had the wonderful intuition to pair us up to work together. And I couldn't believe my good fortune, because what an artful, gifted young woman she is. And I think I probably said to you something like, you know, because I'm like this old woman, you know, I said, oh my God, you're going to go far. And within a year, you had your book, The Heart's Traffic, was accepted by Red Hen Press. And she went off to get her MFA, and you know, probably just a few months in, it must have been when you got it accepted. It was at the next AWP. It's a gorgeous book. It's for sale there, so you may want to take a look at it. And she's just really kind of coming along, doing critical stuff, writing, and she's actually from my hometown, right, in Massachusetts. The daughter of Chinese immigrants. She's a Kundiman and Lambda Fellow, a member of the Mikondo writing community. She's a community organizer. She's worked in the Asian American communities of San Francisco, Oakland, Riverside, and Boston. Basically, wherever she goes, she spawns activism. She's been a resident at Soul Mountain Retreat, Voices of Our Nations, Vermont Studio Center. She's a co-editor of The Revolution Starts at Home, Confronting Intimate Violence Within Activist Communities, forthcoming from South End Press. Join me in welcoming Chingyi Chen.
Thank you so much. Great. Well, let me know, as Christine said, if in the back you can't hear me. And thank you so much for inviting me. And this is a beautiful space. So thank you to the artists who made the space and the organizers behind it and the fellow writers that I'm reading with and the audience. So I'm going to start with a poem called The Mending Myth. And when Nina asked me, "Oh, do you have any work on this subject?" It's like, "Yeah, every single poem I write is related to a myth." So I thought that was very fitting. The Mending Myth. Once a road sprouted lonely, built up from mountain. On the road was a lovely voice with a map of a home she had never seen, drawn from the other wandering singers. Bright red windows, a full storehouse, small shoes for feet. Then the night that nobody believed in, the dawn after pouring, the sky after sun, the bird call, the rain, the soup in the cauldron, the suffocating healing, the clogged up pore of the stratosphere, that essence, pig blood. Broken sparrow leaf, there could be no more brown paper birds, and you could be cinnamon. There would just be that high watermark, how the sun stole you 1-2 p.m., marking you with a bite upon your shoulder until each burnt home in the year everyone left. I was not prepared, but the river came calling and I followed. A year later, I looked into the burning candle window and no one was the same. Then there in the bin, those shoes hung dry. Our voices dry, no way to say I. How we broke into the city through the foggy grime, escape from the bullhorn men, through the mountain crash and roaming eyes, gripped zipper screams for the world of dusk. Which greasy world we came out of, knife sun struck. Then the voice unrolled each tongue and followed the winds which escaped. There was a place, a red, bright home, a small, crouching house in the afternoon. So I'm going to read a bunch from The Heart's Traffic, which actually grew out of a myth, believe it or not, a storybook that I grew up with. And I changed some of the genders and some of the details, but just so you know what inspired it. And the main character's name is Xiaomei. She's a girl who is an immigrant, But the beginning of the book deals with her friendship with another young girl. And this is before she comes to America. And this is what happens in their relationship. So this poem is called Some Say. Some say a little girl fell into the lake that night, and nobody's seen her since. Some say it was a black sky she ran to, a girl in love with midnight. Some say if only. Some say the lake, lonely and hungry, set a trap for winged creatures, and the little girl was too lovely for her own good. Some say they've sighted a little figurine, pale as a shirt washed too many times, drifting in lonely places. Some say when little girls pass, they transform into useful things like lanterns, greeting the weary farmers enticed by the rippling lake. Some say there are no such things. Some say the lake digests all her daughters and births fireflies. No one says, I will miss her my whole long life. I will carve a door in my dream, an entrance that belongs only to her, so I can tell her again and again how I wish we never fought over the stars the night she fell out of my life. So Xiaomei and her mother follow her father to the United States. And I like this theme because I'm reading a lot of poems that I wouldn't normally read. So this is one of them. It's called The New World, a Sestina. I cannot remember the thunder grandfather masquerading as my adult. We did not place our belongings in the refrigerator. Our home lived in the screen of a television, filling the room more than our original smiles. There was a day we filled the one suitcase with grainy smiles we remembered when disembarking like families on television. Minus the grandfather we left begging at the altar of an empty refrigerator. Our legacy's last remaining adult is always become the adult who smiles as he unplugs the lonely pea-green refrigerator and sweeps the last room of all its dust. Will we remember again each grandfather? Each avenue bears a display window, encased television. There are no signs of the missing on television. When you become an adult, my mother explained, we can return to visit grandfather. She smiled, but I distrusted, and now I do not remember. My new family fills the refrigerator now with new treasure. Steel refrigerator and large screen color television, warm and snug in the corners. When I remember, I will be a grown adult with shiny smiles searching for grandfather. Grandfather, we have stocked the refrigerator in honor of your smiles. This legend of television encourages each adult to disremember her own grandfather. In each land, there is a refrigerator filled to the brim with smiles. I want to read you this is the last poem in the book, in the first section, and it's called The True Tale of Xiaomei. This woman with my face is not mine. I do not love her, and she does not love me. Her face would open as the ting announced my arrival. She would sit me down behind that plank, doubling as counter, the Sharpie my weapon to nail her tongue onto placard. I look her in the fierce eye and say, no, that's wrong. You are not saying it right. She would halt her recitation, press her thin peach lips like she was glad I was worth something. Of the twilights, I said nothing, daring her to hang her failures in the window. At school the next day, the girls would gather round and I would unfold the great, outlandish, true tale of my pathetic mother, married off at age 3 to an evil rich man as second wife concubine, how she squeezed sorrow out of her pounding chest, how he beat her for that first daughter, me, how she squirreled away like the workday ant, coin after morsel, how one day the bus driver saw my fresh face and her haggard one, two sides of the mirror of time open onto his pale life. He fell in love with such courage. We, a lovely family, bought passage on the steerage section of the airplane, here to start a romantic, rose-tinted life. That classic immigrant story that breaks their little pilgrim hearts. And who could say otherwise? My mirror of a face ensconced behind a battling cash register, waiting for the munchies of college students or financial district secretaries on lunch break. This face, I, the only authority, translator, writer, communicant, sage, storyteller, shit talker. How would you, oh foreigner, know the difference? How do you not know I'm not secretly in love with this face, which I have never hated as you first imagined this secret society? An imperceptible nod we pass, a shit-talking language in which we say nasty things about all the foreigners we hate. Even now, she is carving up her deep memories for me. I am scooping out her innards, that long imprint of my family before her, hand snaking up what she has stitched shut at the ass. At the station, the old grandmother mumbling poetic phrases in Mandarin, a wrinkled-faced woman who could have been my grandmother, presumed I was part of her family. Filial obligation would move me to point her in the northern direction towards our tribes. In that bleak day, I wanted to talk loudly in another tongue, shaming her for not knowing my other language, for marking me with my difference, a gift from my mother, but I stuffed myself back into my skin. She could have missed this smallest turn, sweet opening, but her finger crept up, touched that nerve, and spilled. Until I picked her up with my split tongue, we bartered for those multiple years of bloodshed, empires, emperors, mandates, for our shared failings as daughters, perhaps not businesswomen who could lift up an oppressed family with one finger. We stood parked in front of that multi-hued subway map at the mouth of the entranceway, that immigrant port city of all the world. Never having a lover with my own family face, I headed home to empty bed. I cried for all the erasures within myself, for the sand I had thrown on my mother's memory from my hard back. To love your own violent histories, the remembered soup of your failings, and to forgive those who have failed before you. Generation upon generation of the most mad, the most terrible, the deadliest secrets crossing the ocean. We do not bury our dead, but hack them into shanks we lay on our backs, burying them forever into each new world. I mention this because this woman with my face is meeting her end. I am still the translator, her fate within the shallow breaths of my hands. Her eyes ask me to tell her the honest brutality, the fate which only I can deliver. Again and again, I am her murderer. I have been training all my life to place each word in front plainly, not to say without saying, as is the tradition of my family, or my tribe, or my country, or my people. To love this only woman with my face. So I'm going to read a little bit also. Xiaomei, the main character, develops this relationship with a community organizer. And so I wanted to read you some of those poems. And she's constantly trailed by this ghost from her past. This poem is called Chew Me, a Riddle. Then a key falling through the dreams of each girl, each letter a crescendo, an urgent lifting, a scab finally taking breath, the tender kiss of epidermis and sky. Then Jing Jing writes, nobody gave him to us, but we dug our hands deep and worked the flesh of our paper sun, crooned to him until we recalled 8 crooked steps upon which the journey rested. The first, the entrance to a cave where a red maiden hid from the jealous winter sun. The second, the love seat of the butcher, which we believed, having seen the entrails of a boar encrusted on the stone. The third, where my uncles were shot. The fourth, never existing because of terrible luck. The fifth, a wedding present. The sixth, inlaid with glitter from the west, brought by the smooth-talking salesman of flesh who visited the summer before we left. The seventh, a stoop used for writing letters, such as those sent across the sea. The eighth, a question mark, because, of course, these steps never belonged to my own blood family, but cramped together in the red book my great-great-great-great-grandfather purchased in the pursuit of the golden sun. These 8 stone slabs, the secrets of his new-bought family, inked into that red book he ate during that crossing. Although he did not anticipate that the foreigners would keep him hemmed in at the edge of the Western Hemisphere with a gang of cursing men who had been sold the same song by smiling salesmen and who passed their days shit-talking in rhyme into the grooves of the wood hall for fear of tattling. Years later, I had to go see for myself. I scooped tourist ice cream, collected envelopes from the aunties, charged the rest of my plane ticket, and boarded the ferry to Angel Island, and treaded through those bereft rooms, hoping for a voice to speak. None did. So I crept into my ancestor, stole his breath for a poem I placed in his mouth like a prayer. The West stole the dragon's heart. I came to claim dignity. Out of water, the ants play, but still the dragon will live. And wore those words back home to my people, since who would disbelieve me? So now we have a secret between us, like blood sisters. Okay. I will just read one last poem. And this is a poem with 3 voices, the ghost, the main character, Xiaomei, and the organizer. And thank you again for your kind ears. It's the ghost.
Yeah, you said the ghost.
Oh, it's a community organizer. She's in a relationship with the community organizer. Yeah. Okay. One, the writer. Secret. My skin peat hides under the covers, thunder god, a grandfather, both blisters. A bit apple fed to the monster who feeds. What makes an elephant? Thank hunger, make the bread. 3 is what steals and binds, what compounds in the coffee. It has less to do with me than you. What is sacred is mine in my cup. 2. The organizer. Today, we are a marshmallow before the alarm. Today, I am the waking sky composing a sandwich. Today, I am an ant making room. I am liquid and tilting books. I am the realization that saying yes to A doesn't mean saying no to M. I am creating the feeling of drinking tea at any time of the day. I am creating myself with shorn river tide at the shoulder. I am releasing my unreasonable fear of liquid bodies. I'm releasing the owner of the land. I'm releasing the packed train car and how we cattle each other into spider webs. I'm releasing the grainy mayor. I'm releasing the stranger who thinks we're the same girl because I love that girl who still sleeps when I cling the door to the world shut. I love saying goodnight to the cook shooting straight from the F train in the dawn. I love saying no to the pile as an empowered worker. I love pork and salty fish Fridays. I love that no one took credit. The rally organized itself in the horizon between the metal door and the street. I love how Auntie Joan has no cell phone and all the other women's phone numbers on speed dial in her head. I love that Xiaofeng's dream is of a blue house near blue grass rising from a steaming valley. Three, girl. I milk the sap. I brew the ailing tea. I boil. I secret my girl. I pocket my bitter vegetable like my cheek. I spark. I rim. I glow. I fire. Ants walk up and down my spine. What if digestion? I am of the frozen. I am empty of all motion. I burn down to wind. There are no chairs in my house. In my house, there are 10,000 books in a shrine. No pens because we are poor. The official visits me. I am national treasure and have to prove it. What myth is made of? If only, if only, if only, if lantern. Then the translators pawn their wedding jewelry for pronunciation class, plunk down into pilots, come feed. They bring notebook. They ask question. They write and write and say hmm amongst themselves. There is no water. They say okay. They buy Pepsi. They cannot stomach what is. There is no key. There is no key. There is no key. Milk the sap. Brew the ailing tea. Pocket the bitter vegetable like the cheek. Boil. Secret the girl. Spark. Rim. Glow. Fire. Ants walk up and down the spine. What if digestion of the frozen, empty all motion, burn down to wind? No.
So we're going to go from a strong woman to a revolutionary. Before we do that, I'm going to read a piece from Conversations with Friendly Demons and Tainted Saints, because myth is what I was writing all about. Actually, when Xingyi and I took this retreat or workshop together, it was really all about trying other styles from, you know, kind of stepping out of our poetic comfort zones. We were both already starting it. But this is a poem from the old style, the old performance days. And it is about what happens to women sometimes, particularly in Greek myth, who don't go along with the program. And it's called Daphne Reflects on Becoming a Tree. These riverbanks have always been a sanctuary for loose coins, cigarette butts, beer cans, and wood nymphs such as me. A place a huntress running through her favorite glades can always come back to. Nice place to visit, Pops, but no offense. I don't want to live here. Don't want my feet spreading into root like those laurels you've got clutching at your shores. You see, Pops, I'm not ready to hang up bow and arrow and forsake my hunting ways. You know how it is for wood nymphs in their later days. One minute, the hot conquest of some drunken god. The next, another acquisition in a flock of sheep, cranking out sons in their father's sacred image while the humble mother fades into obscurity, shriveling into obsolescence, from legend to appendage, used up, put out to pasture, sacrificial lamb. Thanks, Pop, but I'd rather keep on running. But now I get that fever chill hearing Apollo's vile breath sour from yesterday's orgy and its spoils. So close, it tickles the back of my neck, and I see days of freedom flash before my eyes, soon to be a thing of the past. For worst and last, you can't outrun the gods. And Daddy, you say any wood nymph would be thrilled to lay down bow and arrow to whisk out offspring for such a one as he, but I maintain it's not for me. And Daddy, you don't understand. You tell me it's my birthright, then you turn me to a tree, which seems an awful price to pay to opt out of the rape of gods. For what else would you call it when one is chosen by a hunter such as he and God to boot, an innocent frolic among the lambs it ain't? You see, he may be a god of light, but he's sure no saint. And Daddy, you can't sympathize. Don't you get that it's one hell of a spell to be turned into laurel and locked in such protective custody, no longer a lover of woods, but of them, no longer to kiss the trees, but be them, seems an awful price to pay. And Pops, how could you think this coarse and tortured bark might improve me? To protect me from the tingling brush of April breeze against my skin and fingers, lost within a fan of twigs and tender leaves, adoring heaven, never to know the freedom of the hunt again, the loss of this soft and limber flesh and the thickness of a trunk, you call this choice? You've sunk me, ankle deep, torn between Apollo and your ghastly riverbank, forever. And by the way, did you notice the deity wearing that jaunty wreath of laurels on his brow? Somehow he was gonna have his trophy. And maybe any other wood nymph would be proud to lay down bow and arrow just to spawn his strapping young. But get this, Pops, it ain't for me. So we're going to wrap up with Jenny Priego, who at some point when we were going back and forth about this this show was in Vietnam and I don't know where else. She was all over the she was just all over the place. And she is the photographer of the two pieces up front there. She's a visual and performance artist. I think we'll make time for the sirens. She's brought the sirens to us. Who draws inspiration from her existence as a feminine being. She uses several forms of media to interpret her self-exploration, such as technology, her body, voice, and formal fine art technique. Adelita Pata de Perro is an ongoing project based on the Mexican Revolution's Soldaderas. You know, I'm not going to read all of the rest of this because I have a feeling, I'm hoping you're going to kind of introduce it in your own words, which you can do much better than me. So give a warm, warm hand for Jenny Priego.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me here. This is very special, and I feel so very honored to be here with such amazing people. Well, I'll start off by talking a little bit about the project, and then I would like to share some of the memories that I have collected from the pilgrimage of Adelita, which sort of reminds me of what Maureen was talking about, pilgrimage and journey and voyage and warriors, which we all are. So Adelita is a performance character I developed in 2001. As a performance artist, I develop characters that deliver a message without the use of words. My image is altered and I am on observation for the world to see, provoke thoughts, break boundaries, and interact. This specific character was chosen and cultivated for very personal reasons. I am a woman of Mexican origin who identifies and has always admired the revolutionary Adelita. I admire her for her resourcefulness and power. In this project, I glamorize her and I shoot her all over the world. She is placed in several situations globally and captured by camera. I usually travel alone with the tripod, camera, and my costume. The experience has been beautiful and has personally helped me evolve and grow as a woman and artist. As time goes on, I change and so do the experiences I have shooting the project. It goes far beyond what meets the eye in terms of the experience and all that can be shared interacting with my global audience. My stories are the heart of the project, and I plan to share all of them one day. I am so passionate about continuing the Adelita journey that I have taken a job as a flight attendant to fund the travel expenses. Adelita pata de perro, meaning foot of a dog, is a true blessing in my life. I will now share some of the experiences and memories from the locations I shot at to give you an idea of what it's like. So I'll start with Rome, Italy, 2001. It was an incredible experience. I met one of my best friends on this trip. He was a photographer shooting a project of his own, interviewing drag queens and ladies of the night. Carlos, which is his name, came from Spain and was excited to meet me, a self-proclaimed Adelita roaming the streets of Italy. Our introduction was magical. I was 22 and was shocked that the Spanish guy introduced himself by stealing a kiss and saying that I was officially colonized by a Spaniard. Very romantic. The actual shooting of my project went well. I was allowed to shoot in the Coliseum using my charm and good manners, my good Mexican girl manners. So that was really wonderful. And at the end of that trip, my camera was actually stolen. So it was pretty crazy. But that was like my first real try at this. I did a few other shoots in Chicago and Pilsen and Little Village and basically where my actual journey started. And most of the trips or locations I picked intuitively. So next was France. Carlos, a Spaniard, came with me. We were officially in love. He volunteered and volunteered to assist me. We shot most of the this is juicy secrets. We shot most of the project in the red light district. The entire trip was amazing. We had a magical time and fell very deeply in love. We ended up celebrating in New Year's Eve at the Champs-Élysées. So it was just, you know, it just started off very innocently and every location was different. The images that are in the front of the gallery are Sedona, Arizona, and I chose that location in April after it became very ugly politically there. And let's see next. A lot of these memories are pulled from my actual diary. So let's see, I'll talk about Bangkok. I'm still processing this trip. I learned so much about myself there. I was disgusted and terrified from the intensity of the sexual exploitation of women and children. I do not feel safe. Instincts I never felt before were turned on full power. I was afraid to shoot, but wandered the streets looking for locations anyway. My curiosity intensified within a few days, and I began to lose fear. There were young prostitutes everywhere, so many men on a mission to solicit on their special trip. I had no idea this was happening. I expected temples and monks, but not this. I went as far as entering the seediest parts of the city to see what this was all about. One area literally felt like a Disneyland of sexual hatred toward women. It was awful. I was given menus of disturbing live shows to see as I walked the streets. This was a nightmare. Men trying to grope me as I wandered and read the descriptions on the disgusting menus. This was not sexy. It was sick. Some of the females looked so young and were barely developed. After taking in the city, I decided to shoot some images at the Royal Palace of Bangkok, which felt safe. I will never forget this trip and the women I connected with through smiles and eye contact on the street. I tried to connect with as many as I could in this way to let them know that they were human and try to create some good energy. This was a shoot that pushed Adelita Pata de Perro to a whole new level and evolved the project as a whole. I would like to empower women through art and let them know that they are important and not alone. This is a mission and a driving force in this project. It is about connecting, opening boundaries, healing, growing, and being strong. Thank you. Does anyone have any questions? Thank you. Marie?
I'd love to open it up. Yeah, go ahead.
I was wondering if there was any chance we could see any of the other images. Do you have them on your
Oh, on my computer? You know what? I might, and I would be happy to show after the session. Anybody else? No?
So where are some of the other places that you've been to on this journey of yours?
I've been to Vietnam, Argentina, I've been all over Europe. I sometimes go on my own, just intuitively, if I have the time and the resources to make the journey out. And other times I'm just on a layover and I travel with my Kanana belts and my outfit and my layover kit. And I shoot and I write and I collect my memories. Yes.
I'm wondering if you've done any self-portraits as a flight attendant. It's just interesting, kind of a profession with that history of gender. And
I do, actually, and I have my current project that I'm working on that comes after Adelita Pata de Perro is based on the life of a stewardess. And I use that in performance art a lot. I portray a very pristine flight attendant. Other times, a not so pristine flight attendant. But yes, definitely a part of my artistic and real identity.
Yeah, cool.
Yes?
Understanding Adelita, she wore bullets across her chest and around her back. And you're getting through security with this in airlines, right?
Yes, actually, Chicago security, I believe there was a memo sent around because I became really friendly with the security there, and they know what I do, and a few of them are my friends on Facebook, and so they know, and they are supportive to the arts in that way. So at least getting out of Chicago is really easy.
And getting back?
Getting back, I haven't had a problem either. Yeah.
You're probably glad to see you and your bullets.
Yeah. Just go with your ammo, please.
Wow.
Yes,
amazing. I'm just curious for a little more detail about how the Mexican Nice Girl works the bureaucracy of actually getting into official places like the Coliseum and
just
having permission.
Being polite, really. I really don't have any formal paperwork or release forms or anything like that. It's really just guerrilla photography. It's me, camera, tripod, and just like my good old-fashioned manners, and It gets me really far.
So whoever you run into, you just say,
May I please shoot here? Yeah, and people are so nice. And I do talk a little bit about the project, and strangers help me. In the Sedona, Arizona pictures, a nice gentleman loaned me his gun. He was walking by with a gun. People are very kind and generous.
Mine is a shallow question.
Sure.
In which country did you get those gorgeous earrings?
Oaxaca. I was in Oaxaca. Yeah. Yes. And gorgeous. Actually, my last shoot was Oaxaca, and that is quite a magical place. I hope to go back.
Those are just like Frida's. She had a pair just like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you have it mapped out where in the future?
No, never. I never map anything out. It's just I go on gut instinct, and if I have the opportunity, and pure intuition. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I never plan. I do use maps a little, but even, I mean, I don't even know where I stay once I get to a place. I just go. I go with it. I just show up.
Did you have a question?
Marie?
Have you had or will you have an exhibit with all the different countries represented?
Yes, I hope to. Oh. Yes, that's the plan. Yes.
You know, one of the things that we talked about or emailed about was we were hoping to get Honest Castillo in here for this.
Oh, yes.
But can you say something? Does your relationship with her, you know, has that influenced this project at all?
Oh, she is... She's working a lot with memories and memoir workshops, and that was the way that we connected. I was one of her students in her workshops. And she is a huge inspiration to me. She's, you know, I think one of the greatest writers, women writers, men writers, just really powerful.
Just for the archives of public radio, do you want to just say something about her, you know, some of her books, or not to put you on the spot?
Oh, no, absolutely. Well, I would, you know, for me, it's really been the workshop that she is traveling through the country and the world with, actually. Uh-huh. I believe she's taken it to Argentina and other parts globally now, but... the importance of our memories and honoring them and working with them with words and images is so important for all of us. And she's really taking that to a whole new level by sharing her expertise and her knowledge and her magic with people all over. So yes, definitely, that definitely influenced me, and that's our connection. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions?
Going along with the simple one, this is a bit banal. Could you talk about the performance, actually, that you do?
The actual performance is very simple. Really, it's just a transformation. Performance art is, in my my interpretation of performance art, is the essence of acting. It's not actually acting or theater piece. It's connecting with the people. So I show up looking like this, or even in, you know, just like a very simple traveling outfit. And I just start putting on the layers, start putting on the makeup. I put on a false braid and the belts. I transform myself, and people want to help. People want to connect with me. I've had women help me fix my hair. If it's out of place, they run up, they say, no, wait, you know. I've had people protect my objects, my purse. So it's a communal art project in a lot of ways, and that's part of the performance. I've made many friends.
Well, I would love to have you back at some point to do that.
Absolutely. I'd love to anytime. And I'm on Facebook. I'm on there as Jenny Priego or Adelita Pata de Perro or Jenny Pata de Perro. So just look me up. Nina has my information. I'm jenny.priego@gmail.com. Yes?
Do you come to the school systems?
No, but I would love to.
Okay.
I would love to.
Wonderful. I'll talk.
Okay, absolutely. I love working with children.
Shelley's a teacher, so you may have a school in your future.
Okay. Well, thank you so very much.
I want to ask you one last question. If this would have been your wish, you know, to have this reading, which it was really just serendipity that we were able to include you, how did you feel about how the work as a whole here today dovetailed with your work and your thinking?
It bordered on scary and magical because it really just all came to, I mean, it's pretty amazing. I don't even have words for it. It's very, you know, I feel like we're all family. All of the artists that read, and obviously the audience here that believe in us and support us, because I felt like all of the work was related very closely. So I felt a sisterhood. You mentioned sister earlier, and I thought, yeah, she's my sister too. But we're all, I would love to exchange information, but yeah, it was all very closely connected. Very intuitive of you to put us all together.
Yes, well, it was just wonderful to have. Oh, did you have one more thing?
Could I make one more statement?
Sure. Yeah.
I've just been inspired to say something in, not to be negative about some other place, to be positive about this one, but it is such a gift that we have this quality of art and this kind of a celebration of the anniversary. I was in Mexico City this spring, and it's the 100th and 200th anniversary of the two revolutions. And there was a very sad, big political government-sponsored photography exhibit with huge color pictures celebrating the indigenous, all clean, you know, everybody in very clean, shiny huipils, nothing but, you know, dark indigenous faces, as phony as a $3 bill, all of it, because there was no real art in it. And it's just really wonderful to know that Chicago has this, not only the infusion of the art that comes from Latin America and from all over the world with immigrants, because we're such a rich city, but also just woman-made gallery and something like this exhibit.
Thanks for the advertising. That was more than flattering. We've had Jennifer Yeda, Susan Slaviero, and Shingi Chen, and Han for all of them. And I thank you guys all for coming.
And if you want to hear this again, check out Chicago Amplified on Chicago Public Radio, Woman Made Gallery, and within about 2.5 weeks, you will, with Kurt's crossing his fingers, you will be able to hear his recording and see the pictures that I am about to take with all of the readers. So thank you all for being here today.